Okay, this is the interactive portion of the program. We'll take your phone calls this hour with Sir Charles Schulz III as we talk about all things space, so get ready to go. And welcome back to Coast, Sir Charles Schulz III with us. We'll take your calls. Sir Charles, I want your reaction to President Trump's plan to develop a space force, another branch of our military up there in space.
You know, it's actually not a bad idea. If nothing else, it's going to help us drive our technology. And a lot of people think of this as he's going to drop troops somewhere in the world in 45 minutes or so, but that's not really the case. It may be the case, but mostly we'd probably drop drone hardware all over the world fast. We wouldn't really need to send a lot of human beings around to fight a war. We've got some pretty advanced drones and robots.
Well, and why I think it's a great idea, and we should have had this a long time ago, we need to protect our satellite systems.
And that's an excellent, excellent point. You know, I think one of the things I'd like to point out is our slow development of space travel has really been due to the fact that the government treats space industry as if it's a socialist thing. They set the market, they design and set the products, they choose who gets to buy them, and it excludes everyone, and the innovation isn't there. When private industry got involved, all of that changed. So this is a great step forward because Trump specifically stated he was going to call on private industry if he had to.
I mean, if you are in war with a country or about to go into war with a country, one of the things we take out is command and control. And
Exactly. You
have to take out the satellite system because their cell phones will go down, their communications will go down.
Right.
It's an unfortunate part of war.
Well, there may be cleaner ways to do it. I mean, imagine launching a large aluminum foil bag that simply snags a satellite, wraps it up, and blocks all the radio waves without breaking it into fragments.
Absolutely. Are you ready for some calls?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's start by going east of the Rockies. Sherry is in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Sherry. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. I love listening to you. You are both brilliant men.
Wow. Thank you.
I have two questions, which is it true that China and Russia can knock out our satellites? My second question is, how do we stop an asteroid from hitting this planet? And I wanted to say also that three of the reasons why I believe in God is because of biblical prophecies proven true, because of healings in the Bible and in me, and because of answered prayers.
All right, great. Well, we were just talking about the satellite systems and developing a space force to possibly knock them out if we're at war or battle. But they have capabilities now, don't they, to take out our satellites, Charles?
Well, absolutely. And one of the ways to do it is simply send a sack of BBs up there in a reverse orbit. It's not hard to take out satellites. And in some cases, it can be done with an intense beam of microwaves from the ground. You know, there are numerous ways, and Russia and China both can take out an awful lot of satellites, and we would really be in a mess. But the problem is the damage would also spread to their satellites. One of the things
that's right
from doing this is there'd be a stalemate. It's what they used to refer to as a Mexican standoff. They destroy their own systems in the process, quite likely. And as far as stopping an asteroid from hitting the Earth, you know, there are there's a simulation going on.
Well, NASA's doing a lot of work in that area right now. It's all over the news these days.
Yes, they're doing a simulated maneuver to see what would happen. That's one of the things they're planning as we speak. Now, one of the easiest ways to do it, realize that you don't blow it up with a weapon. You don't send a big bomb up there and blast it, because now you have millions of fragments coming down, and it does damage spread out over a huge area. It's just as bad, if not worse. What you need to do is get a spacecraft there quickly that can then, if powered by the sun, thrust the satellite constantly in one given direction to make it miss the Earth. Because if it's headed for the Earth, it only takes a certain number of seconds for the Earth to get out of the way. If you have 7 minutes, you have an opportunity to miss the planet. If you can deflect its course by 7 minutes of arrival,
Jeez.
It will miss the Earth. That's all it takes.
And you really don't want to blow it up, because the fragments could be just as damaging as the original asteroid.
Exactly. They could do a lot more damage in some cases, I would think. And here's the other thing. Most asteroids we expect to be a solid rock or a piece, but many of them are rubble piles of rock and dirt. You know, how do you push that? Gently, very gently.
Sir Charles, do you think that there are satellites in space right now that have nukes on them, whether they're ours, Russia, or China's?
I have no doubt of that. And I often wonder sometimes if the developments in space travel were intentionally slowed down to prevent people from accessing some of that hardware.
That's dangerous.
Well, it's terribly dangerous, but, you know, we live in a dangerous world.
Is it perhaps is it a deterrent? Does the fact that maybe all three countries know we have them up there, everybody has them up there, does that keep things at bay?
It may, but I mean, that only works up to a certain point. And, you know, it only takes one accident to set things off. We've been very close to annihilation a couple of times in the past. And, you know, if you go do a little history research, you'll find that we've been saved by the skins of our teeth just a couple of times at least. But having weapons of that sort in orbit all the time, it just means faster delivery. But the fact is, we can deliver almost anything to orbit very quickly right now. I can assure you there are vehicles ready and fueled to launch at a moment's notice to put weapons in space so that they don't stay there and aren't accessible to people.
On our wild card line, let's go to Walt in Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George. As usual, it's always great to be on with you, George.
Thank you, sir.
George, Sir Charles is the best guest you've had on since Dr. Alan Stern.
Well, thank you.
That's a pretty good compliment there for you, Charles.
I wonder if Sir Charles would agree with Dr. Carl Sagan. Obviously, he was a great advocate of space exploration, but Dr. Sagan said that the great expense in space exploration was in providing, obviously, for the redundant life support systems to, support human beings. So I think, you know, with all the AI we have now and the smart robots, I don't think there's as much of a reason anymore to risk human life in space. I mean, obviously, if you go back even to 67, it's hard for me to understand why the Apollo 1 fire occurred. You know, why didn't the engineers realize that, an O2 atmosphere would be very conducive to a fire?
They probably never thought they'd spark, I guess.
They did know that it would, and that's why later they went to, they were at 4.3 pounds of oxygen pressure, pure oxygen. They went to 5.6 pounds of oxygen and nitrogen to lower the risk of fire greatly, but they never expected the arc that would set it off, and that was the issue. People were aware of it, but they were trying to make the hardware as light as they possibly could, and it was a devastating loss. But as for AI in space, we are getting better systems that have the capability of doing things, and we need it, because if your spacecraft is on Mars or around Jupiter, you don't have time to send instructions and wait and see what happened. The machine has to know what to do. Here's the issue. If you make it so smart that it can figure anything out, it may ask, why am I doing this? Am I going to get killed doing this? I mean, a thinking machine might have just as much ability to want to stay alive as a thinking human.
Sounds like Cal from Space Odyssey.
Yes, exactly.
That could happen, though. I mean, once AI becomes so emotionally intelligent, it will begin to protect itself.
Well, and many systems, particularly the ones they're building for warfare, have those capabilities built in them. They recognize a threat and they defend themselves. Otherwise, they would be useless.
Indeed, indeed. Walt, thanks for your call. Let's go next to first-time caller Eli in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Eli. Good morning.
Hi, George. How are you today?
Great. Thanks.
So I have two questions for the guest.
Okay.
And my first question is, what is Sir Charles' opinion on the picture of the black hole recently? And question number two is, what are his number one concerns of humanity maybe living on the moon and other planets in the future? Like, what is his number one concern?
Okay, the concern. Let's take that one first, Sir Charles. We've had Michio Kaku believes that we need to leave the planet. The late
sure.
Stephen Hawking believes we need to get ready to leave the planet.
Well,
what about you?
You would never, as a bird, you would never grow up in the nest. You grow up and then you leave. You don't live your life in the nest, and the Earth is our nest. And Carl Sagan was very verbose about that, And why I would say that our biggest concerns would be when you have large populations of humans living in isolation from each other, there can be some things that change in their viewpoint, their information, their environment. It will change the way they think and feel about humanity as a whole. In many cases, this means the development of, antitheses, people who don't like the way things are being done by the people that sent them there, or people who don't like what the colonists are doing out there. We have to be cautious that by isolating ourselves, we don't create different factions. That, I think, would be my greatest concern. One of the great things about having separate colonies, of course, is great new ideas emerge in different environments, and they can go with them without a hazard to the rest of humanity. Right now, we're in one glass cage, and if anything happens to our environment, we're all gone. So it certainly makes sense for us to spread out to other environments, absolutely. Now,
the picture that was released a couple weeks ago of that black hole, what'd you think of that?
I think it's an amazing achievement, and I think I'm also a little disappointed by so many people saying, well, it's all blurry. Well, yes.
The image, of course it's blurry. a zillion miles away.
And it's all done, second and third hand, inferring it from the data and then reconstructing what must have created that image. I think that it's really important for us to recognize that we're getting better eyes on the universe. That whole picture, the black hole picture, is the first of its kind, and it took an astounding amount of work to generate it. But it shows us that our theories are correct, that what we thought is true is actually happening out there. That's an amazing achievement. The universe is a message, and we read it and interpret it. We're the interpreters.
What excites you the most, Sir Charles, about space?
I think it is the limitless possibilities that it embodies. For me, there is unlimited resource, energy, places to go. It is an exotic place to think of living. And you know, in a sense, we all do, but we're stuck on one planet right now.
I think the marvels of the universe are so extensive. Everything, I think, is just wondrous, don't you think?
Oh, I do. I mean, just picture this, like the exoplanet around Proxima Centauri. That place has got to be truly weird. Your sun is only about 5% the distance. It would be about three times larger in the sky, and it would be very, very dim orange. Your planet would undergo 400 times as much X-rays from its star. There'd be flares all the time. You'd be living in twilight, and your year would be 11 and a half days long.
Yeah, that's true.
Place to live, you know.
Back to the other wildcard line. Carlos is with us in San Francisco. Hi, Carlos. Thanks for calling.
Good evening and good morning, gentlemen. Interesting call. I would like to say a comment to your guest that I really appreciated his articulation about the God factor with regards to being creation and creation happening with intentionality and how that somehow translates into hope. I really appreciate that line of thinking. That having been said, the guest at the top of the hour said something to the reference about the privatization of space exploration, which I think is a great thing. But what I would like to pose to your question is that even better that space is becoming more privatized with, say, Elon Musk and alike, given the increased acrimonious climate politically to the preservation of the space exploration program nationally and internationally in the U.S. And secondly, the second question is with regards to, say, initiatives like the Green New Deal and stuff like that, is these kinds of initiatives somehow, could they potentially undermine the advancement of a space exploration, whether it's politically, by our government promoted or sustained or by private industry? And third, my last question is that, is there anything from space exploration that indicates that we can somehow repair our ozone? And that's my questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, start the ozone one first, if you want.
Well, the ozone does seem to be getting better. There are now
on its own.
Yes, because we stopped exhaling a lot of the freon-based compounds and other materials that break it down. A single molecule of most of the freons can break down from 50 to 300 molecules of ozone in its lifetime before it decays. So, you know, the fact that we stopped exhausting the stuff really helped, and the holes are healing. But there are cyclic properties, and part of it is how much sunlight, you know, ultraviolet reaches, for instance, the poles, and also what sort of freons, and they're naturally produced in volcanoes, get exhausted into the atmosphere from those natural sources. So you're not going to get rid of all of it, but you're going to get rid of a lot of it. And we seem to be in pretty good shape right now. Yes, we could make more ozone. There's a number of schemes to do it, but they're pretty big in engineering challenges at this point. Now, let's see.
The other one was privatization of space. Yeah, you think that it's a good thing. Can we be held hostage like a James Bond movie where, you know, some company says and holds other countries hostage by basically saying, we've got missiles in space and we've got nukes up there now. We're coming after you unless you do this, this, this.
Well, it's certainly possible, but it doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't.
There's a limited amount of land area and clean water and clean air on the Earth. I mean, you start nuking people, you're burning your own bridges, and that's not very swift.
Plus, we'll send our armies into them, wherever they may be.
What I see is that we tend to use more subtle or devious methods to control other people. We topple economies financially, and we undercut technology, and we do, you know, we do underhanded things or sneaky things or whatever you want to call it to try and keep things under control. And it doesn't always work, but it's their, you know, it's their only game going right now. We don't want to nuke a lot of people or poison a lot of people because there are repercussions, big ones, and we're facing a lot of environmental repercussions right now from things we've done inadvertently. But what I would say is this. When the plant grows up, it doesn't try to preserve the seed. The seed was the source of the plant.
That's right.
And the same thing applies to an agency. NASA, which evolved out of NACA previously, was basically into aeronautics and aviation, and then, of course, space transport. They have set the foundations and done a lot of the major work. It is time for someone else to take over. The seed is done. It's time for the real heavy lifting to be done by industry. I mean, think about it. What if government ran all the restaurants or ran all of the car companies or, you know where I'm going? You wouldn't have the diversity and the open market we have.
And our meals would be late.
Oh, my gosh. No kidding.
Hey, his other question was about these initiates that are out there that could affect space programs and things like that. Do you see that as anything that could be worrisome?
Well, I don't, because most of the space programs that are affected are those funded by the government, which means funded by taxpayers. They just shift hands. They change from a university being paid by NASA or the government to do a study to a private company somewhere doing the study. Or, you know, you simply change where you're doing the work and the viewpoints you have in doing the work. Most of the really best creative work comes from unexpected places. And I don't just mean the garage entrepreneur or inventor, but people who have an idea that nobody in the traditional system would have thought of. The traditional system of education isn't really that great at producing new ideas. It takes the brilliant individual who's injected into the system to come up with those ideas. And we need to put more value on intelligence than training.
Good point. Stick with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with Sir Charles Schulz and take final phone calls with him before we start talking about dreams, his books, Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars, The Living Galaxy, and his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, Jennifer Dumper joins us as we talk about your dreams. Looking forward to that. Don't go to bed. Don't dream yet. Just wait for the rest of the show. We're going to come back in a moment with Sir Charles Schulz III and take final phone calls with him as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Sir Charles Schulz III, our final segment here. We'll get to your calls as well as they begin to come rolling in. People love space, Charles. What is it about space that has captured our attention, our imagination?
Well, it's everything that we don't have on the Earth. It's things we can't imagine, and it's just the potential. We've seen that 2/3 of every movie these days is based on some space theme. It's just amazing. It's mystery always appeals to somebody, and we also see it as a place we could settle. That's important, too.
I was captivated when I was a kid, and everybody in our days, Charles, we all wanted to be astronauts. Everybody.
Yes, indeed. I have those thoughts myself.
Where were you when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon?
In the living room, watching it on TV. It was about 1 or 2 in the morning. I was there watching it on a blurry, grainy, black and white set.
Me too.
Fascinated by it.
It was amazing. And even though the video was really grainy, it was exciting, wasn't it?
It was perfect. You know, I couldn't think of any better way to see it. You had a bird's eye view to something on the world next door.
Just remarkable. The technology. What fuels it, by the way? Is it the technology? Is it our incredible intelligence? What got us to the moon?
Well, of course, it was the competition aspect. We wanted to get there before the Russians, you know. There was a big race going on. But at the heart of it, we're always looking for new territories to settle. We're always looking for more land and more resources. I think it's part of the biological imperative just to look for a new place to live and new resources nobody's touched yet. I mean, imagine how you feel when you get out of the mountains, you see all that open territory. You feel a longing. You have to see what's over the next hill. You have to explore it. It's just built into us.
It really is. Okay, back to the calls we go. Let's go to Wildcard David in New Mexico. Thanks for holding, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I walk out my back door, and I can walk 11 miles without hitting anything until I hit the mountain, and then it'd be up over a mile straight up mountain and back down to the side and a few more miles before you encounter the first person. First of all, I love your comic strip. I always have. maybe Snoopy, instead of flying his Sopwith Camel, maybe he should have been going to space.
Maybe.
Well, you know, if you remember the old series, they actually did have him flying to the moon with Neil Armstrong.
Yeah, they did. They did. Go ahead, David.
I didn't see that one. One more comment on something you said, and then my point. I've always suspected that the reason there was a big gap in civilian space travel was because the military was doing some stuff they wanted to keep it secret as long as they could. That was you had mentioned that, and I've always thought that too. And then George you had posed a question, and you had a discussion. And so, what do you think of this on the subject of the randomness or orderliness of our environment? One way of looking at it, and I don't remember how you phrased your question. You can bring it back up, mention it again if you want to, if it comes to you. But you know, we have the perfect environment for humans to flourish, and other animals and plants and such as well. And it seems so miraculous. But if you look at it in the reverse, that whatever given environment exists, only life that fits well in that environment will adapt and flourish and develop and so on. Do you follow me on that one?
Absolutely. That's a fact.
Yeah. And so it makes it, we look at it as, you know, here we are, and how did the coincidence happen that we, as we are, found this perfect environment for us? And like I was saying, the reverse of that is this environment existed and we developed either by trial and error or by design in that environment to be able to flourish in that environment that was available, if you follow me.
Absolutely. I mean, if this environment were different, we wouldn't be in it, or we would be different ourselves to match it.
It's, you know, you brought up something earlier too, Sir Charles, about, and something I've always thought about, the incredible amount of different species on this planet.
Oh, yes.
It is just absolutely mind-boggling how many different kind of creatures there are. And what's also unusual is they've got eyes and ears and mouths and everything else. It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
It is, but they're all shaped by the environment they are in. Otherwise, you know, as the caller stated, they couldn't survive. And if we look out to the universe, we realize that where we live on Earth, we have a very restricted environment that's just right for us. But most organisms on Earth don't need this sort of environment. They could live quite well, you know, sometimes in acid or high temperatures or, you know, choking fumes that would kill us in a moment. So most of the life in the universe is going to live in those truly more normal conditions, not able to support human life. That's the norm in the universe.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Next up, let's go to Wildcard Sid in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Sid, go ahead.
Honor to be on the show with you, Sir Charles. It's an absolute pleasure to get a chance to talk with you.
Thank you.
Nori, love your show.
Thank you, sir.
In the first hour, you spoke about, you said, you know, you believe in God and you have your reasons and everything. And I've always noticed that when it comes to science, everybody kind of shies away from religion. What is your opinion or your thought process on you know, way back in the day before they created the Bible, they talked about God and all this. And what do you think the odds are that, you know, maybe a higher intelligence somewhere else in the universe was actually visiting, like we've talked about on multiple Nori shows, is actually being visited? And what are the odds that that was a visit, but due to our psychological ignorance, we've associated that visit of a mass visit as God, and it was essentially a higher being somewhere else in the universe?
Okay, that's an excellent question, and I think you put it pretty well. When you look back in times in the past, people would see things that they couldn't explain, and they come up with the best explanation they could. I cannot give you odds because I don't have any real numbers to work from, but I think that it's not unreasonable, considering some of the things that have been reported and some of the things we found in recent years, that we might have been visited in the past. You know, and then today, of course, people say, well, everybody's got a cell phone. Why aren't they capturing pictures of spaceships now? And all of a sudden, it's all dried up. I would like to point out something. When you hear the accounts of alien ships landing that people talk about, UFO abductions and so on, they always describe these control panels with lights and buttons. How 1950s can you get? We today have far more advanced technology than that, and we're not going to the stars. So is it sort of an anachronism to think that an alien that has the ability to travel between the stars has less technology in terms of controls and displays than we have? If we were to explore another world, what would we do? We would use tiny, tiny spies, drones. And if we had nanotechnology, we'd send dust into the atmosphere that could see and record everything and relay it back to us without anybody being the wiser. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for an alien being to risk their life and their body in some clunky piece of hardware when, in fact, they could send some invisible, tiny, less size than an insect, some fleet of tiny devices down to a planet and get all the information they need with little or no interaction with the locals. I mean, that's the way I would do it.
Exactly. Indeed. Next up, let's go to Charles in Sacramento, west of the Rockies. Charles, go ahead.
Hi, George. I really appreciate your show, and
thank
I love
you.
To focus on the near-death experiences. They're great. For the guests, I'd like to know if Mr. Schultz can eliminate from his vantage, considering his classifications and stuff like that, if he can eliminate crop circles as being man-made, machine-made, or possibly communications from another planet. And I'd like to remind everybody that as part of the Space Force, a declared battlefield is the electromagnetic sphere of the Earth in addition to space. Thank you, George.
Okay, crop formations. Sir Charles, give us
wow.
your shot.
You know, if I reached out to another planet and I wanted to get a message across to them nice and clear, I don't think I'd mess around with their wheat fields. I would send something unequivocal. You can't argue with. There's absolutely no question what that message is. When you look at crop circles, you see some fascinating geometries and patterns. But where's the message and who's the intended recipient? If you really want to deal with people on another world and you want to send them a message that's plain and clear, you do something plain and clear. You take over the satellites and send a radio message to everybody or a TV message to everybody. You blot out the sun. You send some hardware that they absolutely cannot explain in a way that everybody would see it, and it's absolutely undeniable. You wouldn't play around bending wheat stems. There are a lot of people who've been doing this and converted it to a high art. What I did get a laugh out of was a few years back, they found a couple of fellows in England who were taking a board and a rope and going out and making the crop circles. But then all of a sudden they said, oh, well, these guys have been doing it. And I thought, well, now, wait a minute. These have been appearing for a couple of centuries. These guys didn't do that. But obviously it's not outside of the technology for somebody with a rope and a board to make a crop circle. They do it all the time. And there's a challenge to it. I haven't seen any convincing evidence that it's done by anything other than pranksters at this point. And it doesn't make any sense if you're trying to get a message across to another planet.
What if the planet were alive? You know, the Gaia theory and
sure.
the planet Earth was communicating, trying to communicate with us. That's a possibility.
Well, you know, the fact
never
that
know.
Fish are dying in the oceans, and there's a lot of poison in the environment that's having some horrible effects on the organisms around us. I think that if you want a message, you simply have to open your eyes and look around. The planet doesn't have to be mute, but it also doesn't have to say very much. Just look at our rivers and look at our skies, and there's not enough being done. And the fact is, people say, oh, well, people of the previous generations did all this damage. No, we took our trash to the places we were supposed to. We took it to the organizations that were supposed to handle it, and we were lied to, and they cheated. They threw it in the oceans. They burned it. They buried it. They didn't dispose of it in ways that were environmentally conscious. This is what's killing us.
Let's go east of the Rockies. James with us in Brooklyn, New York. Good morning, James.
Hello. How you doing, George?
Okay.
Charles. I read a book by Charles Lindbergh, A Flight and Life, and he expressed the feeling that he thought scientific materialism is the Antichrist. And in nature, as I understand, as far as evolution, you have as much cooperation as you do a direct competition. But if we're going to understand our universe as being very much material and evolving, whereas in older historical times, the intelligence that organized society, at least as far as human beings are concerned, was a matter of responsibility and honor, and protecting the people working for you. Whereas now it's as if we're under the command of the harshly materialistic forces, and we experience our day-to-day living as various forms of domination, the high cost of living, communication, and so forth. So that's pretty much what I have to say and my feeling. I mean, I'm gripped by this conversation last night and tonight, and by the fact that you do talk about God, which is a deep subject. I think it involves the old historical understanding of relations among human beings. Francis Fukuyama felt that we are entering a so-called post-human age.
What do you think of that possibility, Sir Charles, that we're entering that kind of age?
We actually are. Many of the things we used to do for ourselves are now done by mechanism. And, you know, within the last few years, those mechanisms can include taking our thoughts and decisions and automating them. It's called programming. And so we can take a representative of ourselves, throw it in a piece of hardware, and it'll make those same decisions that we would and execute it faithfully. Yeah, it happens all the time. It is post-human, and we're going to get more and more glaringly into a post-human world when AI starts taking over middle area jobs, you know, middle management, that sort of thing. I don't think that, you know, what Charles Lindbergh said in his book about science being in the Antichrist, scientific information, I don't think that's true in the least, because science is simply a system of learning more from what you have around you, doing a little test, learning, you know, harvesting the results, evaluating them, and learning something. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's essential to our survival. Science simply formalized it. But I do think that what happens is most people act without a moral compass. They act in a way without considering what the moral consequences are. And that's one of the problems we have today in our world. No moral consequences.
And just about anything. So what happens in 20 years with space? What do we do?
I would say in 20 years, we're probably going to hit the singularity and then all bets are off. But I would also say that we're going to be launching extremely tiny things into space, just a few grams, loaded with all sorts of technology, if not nanotech, that when it gets out there, literally grows what it needs from available resources. AI, sensing, and intelligence will be dense enough and fast enough at that point that something that fits in the palm of your hand is going to be incredibly powerful. Just look what we've done with cell phones since, you know, the Star Trek show.
Good point. So, Charles, thank you for being on the program again. We love having you. Up next, let's talk about your dreams on Coast to Coast AM.